And I ain't hit no drop in a minute. No, I'm about my business.
Rapper's Guide Podcast, episode 66. This is your host, Iggy Metro.
Bales Pagliacci.
And today we're on the phone with Eric Abel of the Mac Group. Eric is a booking agent for tours. He's worked with Polo G. Eric, you could actually tell us the artists that you're responsible for booking their shows.
I'm actually not working with the Mac agency anymore, so I don't know if that puts a damper on this, but I have worked with Polo G. The artists I'm currently working with are Scarface, Rakim, Raekwon, Ghostface, DJ Quick, Goody Mob, Chris Webby, Echo, Token, Mavi.
Now we're talking my alley.
Yeah, it's like more legacy acts.
Okay. Now we're talking my alley because I'm not really a Polo G type of guy. I respect it, but you know, I'm more of an old school hip hop type of guy. So if you're working with Scarface, Ghostface, and all these people, then yeah, I'm more inclined to look into it for sure.
That's same with me. I'm a little older, so that's definitely my style.
Now, do you see a major difference when you're working with those two different types of artists, when you're working with more of a legacy act artist versus working with like a new up and comer who's already, you know, established himself, but versus like a legend?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a difference. I think a legend has kind of already seen everything. So they know their value in the market. They know, you know, what they should be expecting. You know, it's kind of been there, done that. And, you know, some of them have already kind of seen the peak and seen like the most that they were ever going to get as far as, you know, their guarantees per show. Mm-hmm. But they definitely know what their value is. They know like how many they're going to draw. You know, in most markets, they kind of already have an idea. A lot of the younger guys, you know, they might not really have much tour history, and they try to set their price sometimes going based on the buzz that they currently have, which is, it's a tricky game because, I'll give you an example. Like there's artists where, you know, I'm pitching them and they're telling me, you know, I need $50,000 to do a show without really having any history in the market. So I tell that to a promoter and they're just taking a wild guess of what this artist is going to do. So that part's tricky, but then it gets even trickier when a week later they drop a single that's, you know, top of the chart, and now all of a sudden they want double. So now they're asking for 100,000 when they've never even done a show in the market. And you know, I might have just convinced the promoter to give me 50 for their show a week ago, and now they're looking at me like I'm crazy because, like, it kind of messes with my integrity because usually, like, if I quote a price, and I tell them this will get it done, then they expect it to be done, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really weird sometimes because I think sometimes some of these younger artists can price themselves out of the market and then they actually just stay home. They only get those one shows every once in a while instead of being flexible and realizing, like, I'm going to get more in New York than I am in Kansas City, or, you know, I'm going to get more in a 2,000 capacity venue than I am in a 500 capacity venue. Like, it's just basic math.
Right.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that I wanted to ask you, because I know, like, one of the things that was circulating around Twitter was when Ice Spice basically, you know, blew up technically overnight, air quotes. But after that, she kind of went back and was saying that her booking price that she was doing before shows, she had increased the price. And, like, you know, at that point, everybody was looking at it from two different perspectives. Like, that's how the business is. And other people were looking at it like, go out and do those shows for that specific price and kind of get that practice going. So, like, how did you look at it? Or, like, if, like, a situation like that, like, how would you look at that?
I think, to me, it's a reflection of her management. And I think, you know, without knowing them at all, if I had to guess, they're probably pretty new at this game. Mm-hmm. And they're seeing, oh, well, you know, her value really is this. Like, she really should be getting more money. But the problem is, like, once you commit to a show, I'm really not a fan of backing out of it for no reason. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a fan of trying to renegotiate things. Like, if I were in that position, you know, on her team, I would say, you know, I think it's good we get through these. Let's build with these promoters and, you know, show them we're worth more than that. And maybe, like, you know, if I worked out a good deal in the first place, there should be a good back end there. So, you know, if I was already thinking ahead, like, she could be bigger, there should be a good back end. If I'm expecting to sell it out, she wouldn't have just walked with that $4,000 to guarantee that they'd worked out. But I do, you know, I see both perspectives, but to me, you know, having been in this game quite a while, I would say, let's play the shows out and we'll go back and get a lot more money next time, you know, but we made a commitment, like, because it really is about relationships at the end of the day. And if you piss off promoters all over the place, like, what do you have left when you need to reach back out?
Now, how often does an artist look at you and say, hey, you're my agent, I want you to get me more?
Mm-hmm.
Does that happen often?
It happens, but I have a pretty good trust with my clients. Like, I'm very honest with them, and I think that they know that, and I think they know I'm going to fight for them. I'm not just going to roll over and just do what the promoter says, but at the same time, like, it, what I would tell the artist is, look, it does none of us any good if the promoter loses a bunch of money on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, now you've priced yourself out of the market. Next time you come through, the promoter's not even going to want to book you because they lost a bunch of money on you.
Right.
So, like, I would push back a little and say, like, where are you getting these numbers? Like, what kind of math makes you think that this is what we should be doing? Because I might say, do you think you're worth $100 ticket? Because if you're not, then the math just doesn't even add up in some of these scenarios.
Now, I want to ask, because there's a lot of artists who, you know, they market their music well and they have big followings on Instagram. They have big followings on Twitter, and their music maybe on Spotify has millions of plays. But it doesn't always play out in the actual market. It doesn't always play out where people come to the shows. So how often do you run into that issue as a booking agent where you're like, yeah, you have a million streams, but you're not selling a 500-person venue out?
Yeah, I mean, it happens all the time. You know, and that's why you really have to put in the legwork to build your touring. It's a different grind. Like, you know, and I know artists who are totally independent that make six figures on their own on streaming now. Like, it's a common thing, and it's incredible, and I think it's super dope, the times we're living in. But if they don't go out and just grind it out to start building that fan base, like, then they are going to be in that position where they're only going to get shows every once in a while. And when you look at the artists that have, like, you know, we talked about legacy artists, the ones that are still around and able to tour are the ones that toured this whole time. Like, they kind of, like, laid the groundwork when they were younger to make sure that they had fans that would come out and see them. They put on a good show. They kept coming back to the market every year. And, like, that's what it takes. And I think the first time you might have to be willing to go out and, you know, maybe you lose a little bit of money on the ticket sales, but maybe you make it up on your merch or meet and greets or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you just grind it out. And the next time you go back, there's double the people there. And before you know it, you know, a few years down the road, you're a major touring act and you're a headliner. And I think, like, a lot of people aren't willing to do that for one reason or another, you know? And, you know, that's my biggest advice for young artists is, like, that's your longevity right there. That's what's going to make you be able to tour in 20 years and still make a good living off it. And if you don't do it while you're hot, then you're never going to be able to do it.
Because that was, like, one of the main things, like, I took from that, what you were saying was, like, you know, now we're living in the age where you could technically make a living off of your streams, where more so back then it was more so like, oh, as an artist, you're going to make your money off touring. But at the end of the day, still in 2022, it's still a big part of, you know, getting yourself out there, getting your name out there. And also, you know, being able to put some money in your pocket is by still touring and try to, you know, figure out how you can get people that listen to your music out to these shows. Because that's one of the biggest things that we always see. Once again, you may have streams, but then you try to sell a room, you can't even get 100 people in a room. So then it's just like, are those, like, really fans, or are they just, like, passive listeners? Like, where exactly is it, you know, coming from at that point? Because at the end of the day, we want to be able to draw crowds in as an artist. That's kind of, like, one of the biggest things that we do look for.
I think it's important. I mean, you know, I know people who have 20 million followers on Instagram that can't sell 100 tickets in a room. Mm-hmm. And then I know people who, you know, might have, say, 3,000 monthly listeners on Spotify in a specific market, right? But they somehow are going to get 10% of those people to come out to their show. And so it's really about how engaged are your fans. Like it's really about having real fans that really support you and buy everything you do. And, you know, that's really where you can make a living. You know, that's where they talk about having 1,000 true fans versus, you know, 1,000,000 fake ones.
Yep.
It's just a different ballgame.
Do you feel like that has to do with the artist's actual music? Do you feel like certain music actually connects with people more than other types?
I think so. Yeah, for sure. I think certain artists connect better with people too. Like they take the time to connect with their fans. And in this day and age, I feel like you have to. Like you used to be able to kind of have that veil in between you and your fans, and mm-hmm. you could kind of have that cloak of secrecy and people kind of like curious of who you really were. But unless you're at a level like Jay-Z or something, it's like you really have to be kind of out there and reminding your fans about what you're doing pretty consistently.
Now, I wanted to ask you a question because you are working with so many legacy acts, and I know that legacy acts tend to have a bigger audience when they go overseas. Why do you feel that is, that in Europe they like those old school hip hop acts more than in the United States?
I was just having this conversation the other day. Like I know a few acts that don't even really tour here that only play overseas.
Right.
I think what it is there was years of those artists only touring here. And so like the fans had already seen them a bunch and they can see them here anytime. Like they live here. So like, I think fans here kind of get spoiled with some of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you live in New York City, you're just used to running into like Cameron or something, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
It's so like, if you're overseas, it really is special, you know? And I remember at a point where Japan just was like the spot to go, and, you know, Europe's always done well in Australia. Certain people do really well. And I think that's what it is. I just think, you know, maybe like some of these artists have already toured the US 20 times. It's not as exciting for their fans who are like getting older kind of and not going out as much. So I think it's kind of that simple.
That makes sense.
Now, and have you seen like so far as like the legacy acts, I understand how, you know, they would, you know, tour well like other countries. What about like any upcoming artists? Because a lot of times for us, we normally tell, you know, artists to market their music, and it kind of sometimes the U.S. isn't their first market just because it's sometimes a little bit expensive, but they may, you know, gain some attention in other countries. Have you seen that as well from like upcoming artists, or is it more so they still need to build like a ground base at home or like somewhere in the United States first?
I mean, I've kind of seen almost the opposite, where some of these younger artists like make a lot of money in the U.S. and then they want to go overseas, but like they haven't proven themselves overseas. And so the offers come in maybe at a third or a half of what they are in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
and they aren't willing to kind of, again, take that road and go prove themselves. Because they're like, well, I get to stay here and make, you know, triple that. Why would I go over there? So it's like, again, you kind of almost have to start over in a new country and start over in a new market and kind of build your worth and your value so that now, again, you have a new territory that you get to travel and tour for years. But if you never go do it, like, you're just never going to, it's not going to all of a sudden, like, in 10 years, it's going to be viable if you never did it now.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that these newer artists coming up kind of have an unrealistic expectation of what they should be making? Because I know that if you're coming from, say, the early 90s, right, where money wasn't as abundant in the touring scene, and now you're seeing so much money where there's $100 tickets. I mean, in the 90s, I'm sure that was unheard of, you know? So do you think that there's a certain arrogance that comes from the new age of ticket sales and the new age of merchandise where you can charge $100 for a t-shirt? Do you think that that's like creating an unrealistic expectation for the youth?
I think so. I also think some of these guys look at their peers and they're like, well, why am I doing this when they're doing that? Mm-hmm. You know? And I think sometimes like they are misled to thinking maybe their peers are making more money, mm-hmm. or they're doing bigger venues. and just not kind of following their own path and their own timeline. It's just an ego thing when it comes down to it.
1,000%.
I also think like the experience of their team is important. And I do, I've seen young managers that are great, they get it. But then I've also seen ones that just don't. And they're like, it's like, oh, I got a college show this one time, for X amount of money. So that's our price now.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm explaining like, hey, college shows just have a budget to like provide entertainment for their students. They don't even care if they make that money back. So how's that your price? You have to really be, as a manager, you really have to be flexible and understand like, all right, we're going to take this here. Then I'm going to go next door to this B market and take half of that. And I'm going to go to this other market and I'm going to take 3/4 of that. And, if you do it right and you route a tour correctly, then all of that should add up to a good amount. And you shouldn't be so stuck on, well, that's going to lower our price.
I think that there's this weird, you see it all the time online where people are like, know your worth. And on this podcast, right, we typically say that, like, you also have to know when your worth is nothing, or you have to know when your worth is low. Knowing your worth doesn't just strictly mean that you should charge more.
Does he believe that you deserve it?
So I feel like that's something that's weird that goes around where everyone's like, know your worth. And if you translated that, it really means, oh, charge as high as you want because you're worth it. It's like, who said that?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people forget that there are actual numbers and data to back up the prices that are being given. It's not like a promoter's, that's their first show they're ever throwing. And maybe it is, but pretty often, I'm pretty sure the booking agent, the promoter, it's not their first go around. They know what you're worth. They know how many tickets you're going to draw. And that's why they're offering that price. And I'm sure there's some promoters out there who try to lowball, but if you're a good booking agent and you have a solid network, I doubt you're going toward those promoters.
The funny thing is when you say that, like, I think about not just artists, I think about everyone in the industry and how there's like, to me, almost a couple different types of mentality. Like for me coming up, I never complained about how much money I was making. I just did it. I just grinded it out. I never complained. And the people like, I feel like who've grown that I've seen grow have that same mentality. Like they never are like, I should be making this much money because I worked 100 hours this week. It's like, no, do you love to do this? Do you want to, like, because I believe the money will come. If you work your ass off, the money will come. And I think it's the same for artists. Like, I think the people who are sitting there counting money all the time and only worried about that are passing over amazing looks, opportunities that are going to eventually lead to money.
You kind of alluded to it before too. You were saying how they look at what their peers are doing, and people are conflating Instagram with like reality. Yep. They're looking at these because dude, I mean, it's all perspective. If I take a picture of a crowd of 50 people, but I take it at the right angle, it looks like 100. You know what I mean? And I think that they're looking at that. They're not understanding the size of the room and that perspective. And I think that everyone is basing it off of something that's imaginary. So it's like, where do you find that middle ground? How do you even approach an artist who has that mindset? Are you willing to kind of have the conversation with that artist? Or is it more like the second that they give you an inkling that they're not approachable, you just kind of move on?
No, I'm always willing to have that conversation. Like, some kind of the things I have to do is kind of educate some of these artists. Like, if they've just never had that, like, information brought to them, and then it just has, it has to be said. And if they don't get it or they don't care to get it, then that's up to them. But like, you can't blame someone if this is the first time out touring. Like, they just don't know any better sometimes. Like, I didn't know the first time I toured, I didn't know what I was doing,
Right.
So I think that's just like important to, it's just important to give them the information. And a lot of these artists are super smart. Like, they get it.
And yeah, that was like one of the biggest things, for us reaching out was like, seeing you on Twitter and it just seemed like you were wanted to educate artists. And that's kind of the biggest thing that this podcast is about, trying to educate artists to be independent and kind of stand on their own and understand that you got to, be able to move through this business and be respectful and more importantly, just have good business and understand that things are going to take time. And it's not going to be instant gratification that a lot of times we tend to look at things because on our phone screen, it looks at that way. And one of the other questions we wanted to ask, like, you know, since we have a lot of upcoming artists, like, I know it's kind of hard to give an exact number, but like, what would you say that it would like cost for an artist to try to begin their touring career or just kind of figure out if they have some markets around, like being able to build like their own tour on their own?
Well, I mean, it really does depend. Like, you're saying, how much is it going to cost for them to like get out and get this started?
Yeah, because I think a lot of times there's a misconception about what touring actually is, because, you know, a lot of times artists probably don't think, oh, I got to pay for, you know, travel there and back. I got to pay for my meals. I got to pay for I want to bring my friends with me, so I got to have them join on, but not knowing that they would have to pay for those things as well.
Yeah, I mean, I try to, you know, I tell artists who are young to try to scale back and slim down and, you know, don't take people on the road who don't have a job. Like, you know, if you have a DJ yourself, you know, a tour manager and maybe a merch person, like, you shouldn't need more than that. Like, you know, people take turns driving, like, and that's kind of how you start out until you're making enough money to pay for other things, you know, and other luxuries. But I think the goal initially is just to get out and get your music out. And it's, you know, you just have to be smart, you know, and make it possible. It's gas is more expensive. Like, everything's more expensive these days, you know, and to be honest, the touring industry as a whole, in my experience, is well down from what it was pre-COVID. Like, the economy's down, ticket sales are down overall, no matter what, you know, I've read in the industry. Like, I've seen a lot more cancellations, a lot more tours getting pulled down. And it's just, you know, we just kind of got to like fight through this at this point.
Mm-hmm. Now, to kind of go off that question, I wanted to ask, I know that like, if you're going to begin your touring career as an unsigned, up and coming independent artist, you need some type of audience in these major cities. So what would you suggest an artist aims for as far as an audience? Like, that could be 100 people in each city, or that could be 500 people in each city. But what do you think is a good starting point for an artist to like market to a city to gain this amount of following?
I mean, I've always kind of said like I always, when I meet with an artist for the first time, I'll have them like pull up their top markets on Spotify and kind of like look at everything over, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 monthly listeners. Because I do believe if you can engage those fans and you can get, you know, a couple hundred people out of them. But anything up and above that is a potential of a market that you can hit. And, you know, I think like how I would go about it is I would start with if I knew LA and the Bay Area were both top markets, right? I would do like LA on a Friday, the Bay Area on a Saturday. And then I know, hey, here's New York's number 7 and Philadelphia's number 9. Like, let's do the same thing over there. Let's just put these 4 shows up on like back-to-back weekends, see how they do. And you know, if those shows blow out and they do great, they sell out small venues, whatever, like, we're onto something. If we sell 20 tickets in each of those markets, it's like, oh, we got some more work to do.
Right. Yeah.
So I think like we have analytics at our disposal now that we never used to have. Like, I say, utilize those and don't just jump full in and go do a 30 city tour without, you know, testing the market and seeing like how people respond. Cause, you know, then you can kind of recalculate after those first few shows.
Yeah. Cause I was watching a Bill Burr interview one time. And Bill Burr said something that in my head was genius, and I applied it to music because, especially in hip hop, I feel like stand up comedy and hip hop are very similar in that it's usually one person with one microphone, and you have to excite the whole crowd. Mm-hmm. So he said that he noticed that all he needed to do was, and this sounds crazy because it's way harder than he made it sound, but he said, if I wanted to sell out theaters, I don't need a million fans. I just need 1,200. And I think that like as artists, quite often, like when we're looking at touring, everyone thinks that you're selling arenas out. And it's like there's so few artists that are actually capable of that, that that's not even something that you should see as attainable right now. I would look at the small clubs and be like, okay, there's a booming club in this city and capacity is 500. How do I get my audience to 500 so I could do a show at that club in particular?
Or 200, you know, right. Like there's nothing wrong with selling out a 200 cap venue. You know, it's all part of the story. To me, it's like you sell out, people aren't questioning like, well, how big was that place? You know,
yeah.
Like I'd rather sell 200 tickets in a 200 cap venue than 200 tickets in a 1,000 cap venue. And it looks kind of empty.
Yeah.
And I also think that when you do a 200 cap venue, there's something more personal about it. Like people feel like they could actually, you know, they relate to the artist in a different way than watching someone from like a balcony and you're nowhere near them. Like you're kind of watching them on the screen more than you're watching them actually move, you know?
And even you see people like Kendrick doing it because he had initially had his performance in Madison Square Garden, but then he had a smaller thing, I think, in Dumbo for like the other, you know, bigger name artists. But it's just like, he's making it more intimate setting. And even though I know it's bigger name artists in there with him, it's all about creating that experience. Like they could have went to the show in Madison Square Garden, but it's better to do it in that setting.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think there's just a different energy in those small rooms and it's a different fan experience for sure.
Yeah. Cause I think it was even like an artist in Louisiana. I forgot the artist's name, but I remember it was like, he only sold like 30 or so tickets and he was just like, yeah, I'm not going to go perform at that show. And it's just like, no, as upcoming artists, even if it's only 30 tickets, like a lot of artists out here can't even sell one. So to have 30 people still be in a room wanting to see you, it may be a small intimate crowd and it's something that you probably weren't expecting and in your grandiose mind. But at the end of the day, there's still people that paid, in 30 people that paid to come see you at the end of the day.
And now I wanted to ask you, how often do you see an artist who, you know, in their hometown, they might sell a bunch of tickets without realizing that a lot of those people maybe went to high school with them, you know, went to college with them, were friends, and then they think they can go to, you know, a different city and sell the same amount, and there's just no draw.
I mean, I think they should know that they know everyone in the room.
Right.
I would assume, you know what I mean? Like, just have some common sense. But, you know, you got to start somewhere. So, like that's part of it. But eventually, those friends aren't going to be fans. So, like, yes. You have to grow outside of that, wanting all of your fans to support you and show up to every show, you know, all your friends, and retweet everything that you do and share all your music. Like, eventually they're going to get worn out. They're not going to do that forever. So, like, you have to grow outside of your friend base and build your own fan base. And I remember, because I came up being an artist, and I remember, like, feeling let down by friends who'd be like, oh, we'll come to the show, and then they don't show up. Or, you know, people, you just feel like people aren't supporting you, but, like, that's not their job. They're not fans. So, you know, you've got to grow your own fan base.
It's so crazy you said that, because we just literally had an episode where he was explaining the same exact thing. And a lot of artists had, like, a lot of flack about it. Like, no, they my friends got to support me. They're not real friends. And it's just like, no, it's just your mentality and how you're looking at it. That's the issue, more so than your friends being the issue.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, a lot of times, too, these, like, the hip-hop communities within a city, like, artists they're so competitive with each other. And I think if they, you know, took the time to come together and work together, like, there's strength in numbers. Instead of, like, you kind of have to put your egos aside, but, like, I support you, you support me, like, and the energy just has to work. That's kind of how you grow those, like, really dope hip-hop communities that aren't just kind of like everyone's in their own little circle.
Right. See, like, I used to put together, and I'm not going to ever lie and say it was on your scale, but I used to put together showcases, and I would take about 8 to 10 artists, and I would put them all together in the same building. We would rent like a VFW or something like that. And just having them all bring 10 or 15 people, it turned out to be a nice show, you know? So
great.
From what you're saying, I agree entirely. And I feel like artists need to understand that that's like a great strategy to look at the artists that are similar musically and to just bring everyone's fan bases together, because it's not only the artists that are introducing themselves to each other, it's the fans too. And they might become friends off that and want to go to the next show because they want to support you. And on top of that, they want to see their new friends.
Yeah, well, what we did when I was coming up, we had this little spot. I came up in Portland. We had this little spot. There was a 75 capacity room. And we did, it was a weekly, and we would take every other week, and then another DJ would take every other week that he would program. But we built it so, like, every week, there's, you know, three or four acts plus two DJs. And it was just, like, such a dope atmosphere that it was packed every week.
Yeah, it's very dope.
But with that, you know, that gave us the potential to kind of build our own community, but also go to promoters and say, hey, we draw 75 people every other week. Like, if you put us on the show, you know, we're going to draw some people, but also, like, we're willing to go hand out flyers. We're willing to go, you know, put up posters. Like, I think the willingness to go, like, put in that extra work is what sets you apart from all those artists who want to just show up and be a star.
And I also think that, you know, artists don't consider that some of these smaller venues, 75 people to them is great. You know, they look at these bigger showcases and they're like, no venue's going to put on a show for me if I don't have at least 500 people. And it's like, nah, it's not true. Like I spoke to a venue owner locally and he was saying, if you can get 75 to 100 people here, you can book pretty much whenever you want. And that speaks volumes to me because that's such an attainable number. Like, I feel like we work with such unattainable numbers because we're not thinking clearly. And if you start looking at the attainable venues and attainable numbers and you figure out, okay, if this artist draws 20 people, which doesn't seem like a lot, but then I get four more artists that draw 20 people, now we have something cooking. And I think that every artist is capable of that.
And even deeper than that, like when you look at it, 75 people for that business is just like 75 people that's going to be buying drinks, probably possibly pay for the tickets to actually come in. And if they got food, even better, they're going to make money off those 75 people. So it may seem like a small amount, but on the business side of it.
Yeah, because that's what
it
matters.
Makes sense. Exactly.
And if you're going to a show, you know, more than likely you're going with friends. You know, one person buys a round of shots, the next person's turn to buy the round of shots. That turns into a lot of money over the course of the night.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, we would just split up the door, like $5 at the door, and we'd split it between whoever performed. And, you know, like you said, the bar, their model's based on making money off their drinks. So everyone won in that situation. And 75 people in a 75 cap room is a crazy energy. It's a fun night.
Yes, like, exactly.
You know what I mean? It doesn't have to be huge. It's like, just make it a special experience for anyone who comes out and sees you.
And that was one of the other things that I wanted to piggyback off on. Cause I remember, I'm not sure, exactly sure where it was, but I remember you was talking about how sometimes artists will just think me, me, me. And when it comes to a tour, that they have to do it on their own. But if you can align yourself with several acts that kind of have a similar sound and be able to look at the demographics and say, okay, we can tour together, split the cost together. Then at that point, it becomes a better situation for you because it is less pressure of like, I have to sell out this whole room by myself. And it adds on to it, like, it doesn't feel like you're doing it on your own. And, you know, that's like something when you were talking about the rap communities to come together. That's kind of something I'd never even thought about it before, like to add other artists on for a tour. But when you had mentioned it, it's like, oh, that's kind of something that kind of escapes a lot of us because we're only thinking about ourselves at the time.
Yeah, I mean, if you can all, you know, split a van and just go, like, it makes a lot of sense. It's especially if you're all friends and you can make it work. We do stuff like that all the time.
Now, do you encourage up and coming artists? Well, I think the answer is going to be yes, but would you encourage an up and coming artist to have a job on the side that they're still working to kind of fund the tour?
I mean, if you have, You got to pay your bills. You have to pay your bills. Like, you can't, you know, I'm a big proponent of taking risks in your life. And I think it's important, you know, to have success in the long run. But I think your risks have to be calculated as well. You can't just like jump off a bridge with, you know, with a 200 foot fall just into cement. I think that as long as, you know, you can make that transition, but I also believe like where you put your energy is where you're going to find success. So like you could have a full-time job and then basically make music a full-time job after work. Like that's what I did. Like for many years I had, you know, regular jobs, but then, you know, from 5 o'clock till 2 AM I'm working on music stuff. And now, you know, I think, yeah, I mean, I think the people who are driven enough to do it are going to do it. That's what it takes.
Now I need to ask, because being a booking agent, especially coming from a music background, I don't see it as like the job that you dreamed of one day, you know? So how did you find yourself in that field?
It's funny you say that. I remember when I was in college, I remember like interning at a label and like just going through some of the mundane tasks they'd have you do and just being like, you know, I was kind of already starting to make music. I was DJing. I'm like, why the fuck would I want to do this for like other artists? Like, this isn't enjoyable at all. You know, it's just like, and there's no, you don't, you know, there's no appreciation. It's just like, you're just kind of doing like grunt work. And that's when I decided like, I was just going to, you know, work for myself. And one of the great things that came out of being an independent artist is learning everything, because, you know, I couldn't afford to pay a graphic designer, so I had to learn Photoshop. I couldn't afford to wait for an engineer to mix my record, so I had to learn to mix it. I had to learn to record everyone, you know, like I had to learn, you know, I had to go through and find all the writers and the blogs and do, you know, send out press releases and everything that I learned. And I remember being on tour one time and we were playing like Boise, Idaho or something. And one of my friends who was there was a DJ was saying like everything you're doing is adding value like to your resume. And eventually, no matter what you do, you're going to be valuable because you can do all this stuff. Mm. And like at the time it didn't really grasp it. But like now, like I work with artists and I can do way more than just book them. There's a lot of things that I do for them, because I could be in the studio and have, you know, some actually have a say. Like people could respect my opinion because I know what I'm talking about. I could be on the road because I've been on the road and I know what it's like to be in, you know, a crappy hotel versus a nice hotel, and like what kind of hospitality needs would actually make you happy. And so like having those experiences, I think, translate. And so, you know, I just learned to book myself and my group. And then eventually, like when I moved to New York, I had one real connection. His name was Rob Swift, my boy Rob Swift from the Executioner, legendary DJ. And he's a friend of mine, and he just kind of let me kind of start booking him. And then like we did, I had a couple of like monthlies in New York that I was doing. And that kind of like started to grow just, you know, my ability to book and start to make connections. And then I applied for a job through LinkedIn at an agency that was a 2-hour commute each way out of the city.
Ooh.
So I was commuting 4 hours. So I'd like leave at, you know, 8 in the morning and get home at, I think, 10 at night to this place called Nyack, New York, because at the time they were doing Wu-Tang Clan. And I was like, I'm going to take that job. I don't care. Like if I have to commute that long. But I did it. And, you know, through that, I just learned how to book. And I was only with that company for less than a year, like maybe 9 months. But you know, the experience, was worth it. And like, I've been independent for like 10 years now on my own, and it's, you know, it's all been worth it.
And that's one of the biggest things that we try to, you know, encourage artists too. Is like, yes, all of us wanted to be artists at heart and we want to continuously make music. That's perfectly fine. But sometimes the skills that you learn along the way become interchangeable to something that you can do in the music industry itself and still be able to make money. You're just probably not going to have the attention of like a bigger name artist, but you're still able to make money from doing something that you love and enjoy, even if it isn't the same way you thought initially.
And I like, honestly, when I was that young, I thought all those people had given up and started working in the industry of punk. Mm-hmm. I was like, you just gave up on your dreams like that easily. Like you know, you don't really want it that bad, you know? But when you, like, I have 2 kids, so, you know, things change in life. And it, like, by the time I moved to New York, when I thought, oh, all I need is these connections and I'll be good, 'cause I'm, you know, I'm putting out music, I'm DJing, I'm producing.
I started to make all those connections I needed, but I run out of steam as far as creating those. And so I wasn't as inspired as I used to be. And like, you just can't control when that comes and goes. But the great thing now is just having been in this independent world, like I've started to connect with people in TV and film, and I'm starting to like be able to get back to creating and doing things in a different way that you just don't know what life is going to bring you. So it's like, I just say embrace it, and you know, the things come when they're supposed to come, and you just, you know, when the inspiration comes, you just take advantage of it.
For sure. Eric, that you've been as great of a guest as we've had. I just want to say how much we appreciate your time, and hopefully we could do this again in the future. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. And again, appreciate your time.
Definitely do. Appreciate you, man.
I appreciate you guys. This is a great message for, you know, just like taking the time to do this for other young artists is important. And it's great that you guys are sharing that knowledge.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. And actually, quick question before you go. When it comes to like the virtual touring compared to like, you know, artists physically going out, I know you said like due to the economy, things have started to regress a little bit. Have you seen like there's still been like an increase in like the virtual, you know, performances, and like, does that like affect anything that you got going on, or is it kind of like you can still work inside that realm, or does it become like a different space?
I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with the metaverse and stuff. You know, I can't predict, but when COVID shut everything down, a lot of people scrambled to start these kind of companies with virtual concerts and just, you know, at home concerts. And I had a lot of meetings, conversations about it. And I just couldn't wrap my head around it being a viable option, because I think there's no replacement for that energy and that community at a live show. Mm-hmm. You know, I know people have been able to do it somewhat, but I think for me to sit and watch you do a show on my laptop for an hour, like, it has to be so captivating. You have to like make it like a movie for real. So I personally couldn't wrap my head around it, but you know, the companies were started that way and there is a new business model there. Maybe if you can take advantage of that in addition to actually touring, you know, why not?
For sure.
All right, man. Thanks. This is a great answer. I appreciate you. We appreciate you for the time, man.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. All right,
guys. Rapper's Guide Podcast. We're signing out. This is Diggy Metro.
Bales Pagliacci.
Peace out, guys.